This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Thanks for the invitation to the Director's Fellowship and also the invitation to speak today and to come up to the museum this week, which has been fantastic. What a lovely place to work. I'm very jealous, having worked at Clayton now for the last 9 months. It doesn't quite compare. As Peter said, I've worked as an oral historian for, I guess, about 25 years now, starting off with work with people like Fred Farrell, First World War veterans. But increasingly in recent years, I've been more and more interested in a wider range of life, different types of life stories, not just oral histories, but also letters, diaries, family photographs, autobiographical accounts, memoirs, and so on. And in the different ways in which people use those different types of life stories to articulate their life, and in what they both reveal and conceal about personal experience and the meanings of that experience, both at the time of the event and at the time of the telling. And I sort of first began to apply this approach to looking at different types of life stories with a project that actually the War Memorial funded, which was to look at different types of life stories of the Anzac landing, about just the first 3 days of the Anzac landing, the letters that men wrote, the diaries that they wrote, sometimes under fire, sometimes afterwards, oral history interviews that had been recorded, and memoirs that people wrote. And I won't go into the details of that project, but I guess I partly did that work because my sense was that military historians were a pretty conservative bunch in terms of how they used their sources and tended to be rather either uncritical or atheoretical about how they used different types of life stories. And there were two sort of main approaches that military historians had to different types of life story sources. One was that the more contemporary, the better, and therefore a belief that if an event was recorded and articulated by someone as soon as possible after the experience, it was more likely to be true than if it was told 3 weeks, 3 years, 30 years later. So that was one approach. And the second approach was a sort of uncritical usage of all different sorts of life stories and throwing them all in together and regarding personal testimony, whether at the time or much later, whether written in a letter or a diary or an interview, as being close to the heart of the experience, as Patsy Adam Smith once wrote. If you like, mixing up lots of different life stories, and if you look at particularly the popular military histories of Australia tend to do that. They tend to use different types of personal accounts, personal testimony, uncritically and atheoretically, as revealing what really happened. And when I did the project looking at those different life stories of the Anzac landing, I won't go into the details of that, but what I got out of that was a range of different ways, a range of different questions to ask of different types of personal sources, personal accounts, to complicate the picture, to complicate our understanding of them, and a number of different sort of headings through which to look at them, one of which is life story genre. What was the genre? What's the genre through which someone's articulating their story? Is it a letter? Is it a diary? Is it a memoir? And what sort of generic opportunities and constraints come with the genre? How do we know how we should write our life in a letter or in a diary? How does that change over time and in different cultural circumstances? What's the difference between the genre of the oral history interview and the written memoir, and so on? And I guess and I should probably add it to this, and the more I think about it, and particularly in this context, because you're all people who work with material culture all the time, you could argue that within genre, or maybe alongside it, there's another set of questions to be asked about the material culture of different types of life stories, about, for example, the affordability of letter writing, the timing that letters take to go to and fro, the difference between an audio interview and a video interview in terms of how it may affect how someone tells their story. So genre and material culture, each influencing how people tell their life stories in different contexts, in different types of life stories. The second sort of framing idea is the idea of autobiographical motivation. We tell our stories with a reason, with a purpose, and that motivation shapes the story that we tell and the stories that we don't tell as well. So the letter that's written home by a soldier or a migrant to reassure family will say certain things, but it certainly won't say other things. So autobiographical motivation is very important. Connected to that, but different, narrative relationship. I'd argue that Every life story is told in some type of relationship, and it's very obvious in an oral history interview when you're talking directly to a person, and who you're talking to is affecting what you do and don't say. And it's pretty obvious in letter writing as well, that the audience for a letter will affect what you do and don't say. It's less obvious, but I think it's true equally of the most private and intimate diaries. Almost invariably have either a real or imagined audience in the mind of the diarist as they're writing. And that sense of a very real, and actually a lot of the wartime diaries were written and were then sent home. I mean, they were another type of letter, so there's a blurring between the genre. But that sense of a real or imagined audience is another thing that shapes the stories that we do and don't tell about our lives. The time of the telling, Sandro Portelli, who's a wonderful Italian oral historian, has this lovely distinction between the time of the telling and the time of the event. And he argues that in oral testimony, which is what he's writing about, there's always a complex, dynamic, dialectical relationship between the time of the event and the time of the telling. And so for me, working with any type of life story, thinking about, well, what is the time of the telling and how is the time of the telling affecting the story is really important. And that's just as true, well, actually, with that Anzac study, one of the most striking differences was within things that were called diaries, between the diaries that were written under fire within the first 3 days and the diaries that were written up a week or so later after the Anzacs had been told that they'd won a wonderful, you know, that what they'd done had been successful. And there's a dramatic difference because of that time of the telling between those earlier and just slightly later diaries. And I guess the time of the telling is significant in two important ways. One, in that the languages and meanings that we have available in our culture to help us tell stories, to make sense of our experience, are culturally and temporally bound. And so with the example of the Anzacs, 3 days later, they learnt what their story meant, and that gave them words and meanings and ways to articulate it. And as over time, as the time changes, the cultural languages and meanings change as well. And I guess that's what Anzac Memories was about. How did these guys, through their lives, reinterpret their lives as new cultural meanings became available? But also, and this is the second subject there, how do we change the story of our lives as our own sense of identity, our own subjectivity changes over time, whether through the process of life review, new attitudes, new ways of understanding ourselves. So the time of the telling is both about, it's about changing cultural and psychological ways of making sense of our lives. And the last one I've thrown in there, which again is, I think you'll be very aware of, is around archival histories. It's very obvious with migrant letters, for example, only a sort of a tip of the iceberg of all the letters that ever get written survive. And so there's a really important question to ask when you're using any type of life story sources, is which sources have survived, whose stories have survived, whose hasn't, and how might we need to bear that in mind when we use this source? And secondly, what are the ways in which perhaps the life story source has been changed over time in its sort of archival history from its generation to the fact that it's ended up in a context and place where a historian can use it? And the War Memorial is great for that because you can see the ways in which Bean and others decided which letters, which writings to keep, then actually cut and paste the bits that they thought were significant and threw the rest out, and then annotated them to give the readers other meanings. And so there's a really... No, so archival history is really important as well. What I want to do is apply those sort of ideas to the work that I'm working on now, which is, as Peter said, came out of 10 Pound Poms, which was a book Jim Hamilton and I did, which drew upon a lot of autobiographical writing and a lot of oral history interviews about the experience of the so-called 10 Pound Poms, post-war British migrants to Australia. And out of that project, where we collected a lot of accounts, four women who I got to know very well have either loaned or donated to me all the letters that they wrote home from Australia in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, hundreds of letters, all the family photographs that they took and kept of their experience as migrants, autobiographical writing from the time, scraps of journals and diaries, lists, inventories of things to take and so on, but also autobiographical accounts that they wrote for our project in 2000 when I was working in England with returned migrants, Jim was working in Australia with migrants who'd stayed in Australia. And in England, we put out a call through local radio and newspapers for returned migrants to get in touch. more than 500 did, and it was a very high, it was about 25% return rate. Lots got in touch. We then sent them a request to write autobiographically about their experience, and about 250 did. Anything from a page to several hundred pages about their lives. It's just, and it fills about 30 boxes in an archive at the University of Sussex. Wonderful resource. But these four women extraordinarily had letters, family photographs, autobiographical writings, in some cases diaries, and then oral history interviews that I've done with them. Because they were migrants, they wrote home to tell their families what was going on. And because they wanted to explain in particular to their mothers and their sisters about their life in Australia, they often wrote in extraordinary and intimate detail about everyday life, about housework and childcare, about their relationships with their husbands, their children, their friends, about work or not work, and about Australia. And although the book, in a way, migration is the thread that binds these four women together, the book that we're writing is really just as much about being a woman in post-war Australia, in 1950s, 60s, early 70s Australia, and about living with and sometimes against the expectations about domestic life and women's role and how they managed that and negotiated that role in the context of that time. These are the four women, and I'll come back. And what I thought I'd do is just use an example, one or two examples from each of them, of some of the different sorts of source, different ways in which they articulated their experience through those different types of life story sources, to highlight both the differences between the different sources, but also how, in using them together, it helps you understand how those different approaches to telling the story worked, and then highlights issues for us using them as historians. And I thought I'd start with Joan Pickett, and this is Joan in the middle on the docks at Aden in 1960 on her way to Australia. Joan grew up in a working class family in Manchester in the suburb of Mostyn. Dad was a railway driver. She had a stepmother because her mother had died when she was very young, but she got on well with her stepmother and a brother called Harry. And she's a bright working class kid, but left school like many at 16 she got further than most. Then got secretarial work through her dad with the railways and was working as a medical secretary in 1960 when she decided to go to Australia. And she sent in to our project a two-page written account about going to Australia. And this is Joan when I interviewed her in 2000 with photos of her time in Australia. And this is the first paragraph of the account that she sent in, and it's also the story that she started to tell in the interview as well about going to Australia. It was a cold, dark midwinter evening in Manchester in January 1960, and a workmate and I emerged from the cinema having watched newsreel coverage of Princess Alexandra's tour of Australia. "Shall we go to Australia?" I jokingly asked my friend. "All right," she asked. "Sorry," she said, in the same jocular manner, and to while away the winter days, we sent for all the £10 POMI information currently being offered to buy Australia House. We were swept along by events, and much to everyone's and our own surprise, sailed through the Suez Canal on the P&O liner Oronce that same September. And the autobiographical account carries on in that vein. It's a sort of breathless account of a young woman's adventure in exotic lands and a coming of age, and exotic, exciting experiences. And as I said in the interview, she, when asked, how and why did you go to Australia, she pretty much started with the same story, told in the same style and in the same terms. It's a story of a joke that spirals almost out of control into emigration. But in the interview, a very different story emerges, and it emerges partly because we started not with migration but with her earlier life history, and so she'd already got used to talking in more depth and detail about her family, her relationships and her life up until the point when she came to Australia. But also because the oral history interview is a dialogue where she's talking to me, I'm asking questions, and over time, as trust develops in that relationship, people open up and they actually remember. They sort of, it jogs memories, it jogs different ways of thinking, and moves beyond that sort of very carefully narrated written account that tells her story in a sort of very well-framed, well-formed way. That sort of framing of the story breaks down a bit in an interview, and we begin to tell more complicated, complex, and even contradictory stories about our experience. And that's what happened in the interview, because in the interview it becomes clear that there's a much wider range of reasons why, more motivations and complicating factors that shaped her going to Australia. Her dad had been in the railway, so as a kid she'd got free rail travel all around Europe and had travelled extensively and developed an enjoyment of travel. She was working in a hospital. There were lots of Australian doctors who told her how wonderful Australia was and that she should go to Australia, so it was in her mind before she went to the cinema. Most importantly, perhaps, she'd grown up in a street where she had three aunts and half a dozen cousins living in the same street, and she'd grown up with them, and all of these cousins and then her brother had all recently got married. She was 26. She was living at home. She was working as a medical secretary. There was really no way in the late 1950s that she could move out of the family home and develop a different sort of life. And Australia offered another opportunity, which she begins to talk about in the interview. And I've got this on the PowerPoint, but the volume's not very loud, so I'm going to play the tape extract. It's not exactly all of the bit that you're going to see on the screen, but it's most of it, and you'll get the idea.
I was always curious to see places, and I think we were getting in a bit of a rut, and as you get older you want to do, and you know, most of my friends were getting married, perhaps I felt I was being left behind somewhere, I don't know what it was, but it just seemed to happen, and we just took advantage of it.
Do you think that thing about maybe getting in a rut and stuff, how important do you think that was for the decision and the going?
Well, I suppose we mustn't have been completely happy in a way, but perhaps we thought I was 26. I don't really know. I've never tried to analyse it. It just seemed to happen at the time, and I just took advantage of it. But everybody was very, very surprised when I said I was leaving home.
So you can sort of see the contrast between the written account and the much more complicated and nuanced story that comes out. And these are two accounts written or told roughly at the same time. The written account was just a few months before the interview. So in those two very different circumstances of telling her story, she told a very different story. And if you'd had one and not, well, if you just had the written account, you'd have you'd have the story that she wanted to tell and that she did tell, but you'd only have part of the story of Joan's leaving England. Let me give you a different example from Joan, which isn't about accounts at the same time, which is about the difference between accounts from 1960 and 2000. Joan started writing a journal when she left on the night train from Manchester Piccadilly. Literally within an hour, she started writing a journal. And a bit like the written account that she wrote in 2000, it was a young journal, a young woman's coming-of-age adventure story. It was sort of adopting that sort of generic approach. She wrote it for the next few weeks on the ship, and then it stops mid-sentence in Ceylon. literally mid-sentence outside a temple. And when she sent me this journal extract, she'd scribbled on it in longhand in 2000. That's as far as I got. I must have been too excited. It's too much else going on. But here is firstly the section from the journal where she describes leaving from Manchester Piccadilly. She'd gone on the bus, they didn't have a car, from Moston to Manchester Piccadilly with her parents. Her brother didn't come, he was too upset to come along. And this is what she wrote about in the journal about leaving. 6960, left Manchester, London Road, on the midnight 11:35 p.m. train to St Pancras after a nightmare last day at home. Was I doing the right thing? Could I turn back even now? By sheer stubbornness and willpower, I kept going. So we waited for the train to move off. The minutes dragged by. Could we still turn back? No. There goes the whistle. The light is green and slowly we pull away, waving furiously out of the window, until the platform disappears in puffs of steam and we enter the dark night outside. We're off. This is how she describes the same moment in the interview 40 years later.
And we sort of got onto this night train, and I always remember it, you know, it was clouds of steam, it was something like Brief Encounters. It was quite late at night. My father was standing there with his raincoat, Miss Trilby on, you know, and he sort of kissed us, and he said, you know, well, come back if you can, but if don't worry about us, you do what you want to do. And her mother was crying, of course, and we were crying. And the train pulled away, and my father sort of disappeared into this cloud of smoke, and I never saw him again.
Actually, let me stop talking for a moment. What are your first thoughts about the difference between those two different accounts of that significant moment in her life? Just any first thoughts?
Well, the first one is looking forward to the day, so what's going to happen?
Yep.
And the other one is reflecting on what did actually happen and events that shaped it.
Yeah. I mean, the really important thing I probably, in fairness, should have told you was that she travels around Australia for 8 years, working and travelling and having a fantastic time, and she probably would have stayed. But her father dies suddenly, and she comes back to Manchester because she's concerned about her mother. And then, although she dreams about Australia incessantly over the next few years and is torn about where she wants to be, she never goes back. So the death of the father's really significant. It's wonderfully visual, isn't it? And it's that lovely reference to the brief encounter, which is that scene in the famous film, and it's one of those examples where she's actually drawing upon. It's a really powerful cultural motif in Britain, sort of post-war Britain, the steam engine and the train and the departure and the leaving and all of that. But yeah, the first one, I mean, clearly the second account is profoundly shaped by the key fact of her father's death, and what becomes a scene of leaving becomes a scene of loss. And the meanings of this, of her emigration, but of leaving Manchester, is framed by her father's death. So the framing of the story, the meanings of the story for Joan changed significantly from a story that's looking forward, that is recognising doubt and uncertainty, but is also a dramatic story that's looking forward to opportunity and the green light and the tunnel and the dark night outside we're off. It's a story of expectation as opposed to a story of loss. So there's a dramatic significance, a dramatic variation between the two that's partly shaped, I guess, by the genre of the journal writing as opposed to the storytelling of the interview. It's partly shaped by the time of the telling and the changing significance of these stories for Joan. It's really lovely to have a moment like that where you can compare two very different versions of the same experience. Let me move on and to look at some other examples from the other women and talk just a little bit about Gwen Good. Gwen Good, with her husband Cliff and three young sons, left London in 1963 and emigrated to Perth. And this is a photo of them on the sports deck of, I think it's the Fair Sky, I can't remember, on their way to Australia. And they were very close to Gwen's parents, who had lived in London and recently moved to Leicester, and they were hoping to encourage her parents to come out to Australia. And so wrote lots. But Gwen in particular decided she didn't want her three sons to lose touch with the grandparents, and basically decided that they would produce audio letters, which they did for the next 3 years until the grandparents were persuaded to join them in Perth. And the audio letters, which were actually dumped at a Baptist jumble sale sometime in the late 60s, were picked up and taken to the Batty Library in Perth, where they now survive. So it's this wonderful resource, and they're great for all sorts of reasons, not only because of the audio stuff. When they bought their first car, they walked out with a microphone and recorded the sound of the engine. And when they heard rain for the first time, they went outside with a microphone to hear the sound of the rain on the tin roof. So they're lovely in all sorts of ways. And so they sent these audio letters home, but they also sent photos home. And that's very common. A lot of migrant correspondence involved not just letters, but also photographs, slides, photographs, photo albums, and so on. And this was one of the first seven slides that the Good family sent home in the first audio letter for Christmas 1963. And the letter had a commentary on the slides, which told the parents what they meant and why they were significant. And it's a very interesting first set of representations of Australia, a very meaningful set of representations where they're trying to convey particular meanings and reassurances to the parents back in England. So there are three slides of the voyage out. There's this one, there's another one of the boys on the deck with a life jacket, and then there's an image of the native traders in Aden. And those three slides are, I guess, both showing the exotic difference of the voyage, but also highlighting that for this working class family, they were having this extraordinary and luxurious holiday, which they'd never had before, and that was good. There were three slides of outdoor scenes in Perth. There was a beautiful image of the Swan River, which displayed the sort of outdoor beauty of Australia. There was a slide of a symphony concert outside the Supreme Court Gardens in Perth, which I think was trying to suggest that this was a place where culture did happen and that it wasn't a backwater. And there was a slide of the gardens of the University of Western Australia where Cliff had just got a job as a carpenter and which confirmed that they were going to be all right economically. And lastly, there was a slide that was sent by special request from Gwen's parents. She'd mentioned in a handwritten letter that they had a lemon tree in their back garden. And Gwen's parents were so excited by this, they wanted to see the lemon tree. So there was a slide of the lemon tree. So those initial photographs and the commentary that went with them were depicting their life in particular ways. It was highlighting that it was going to be okay, we were doing well, this was a wonderful place with bounteous outdoor opportunities and so on. A fruitful life was to be led, which they were doing both for reassurance but also to encourage the parents to come out and join them, because Gwen knew that if her parents didn't come out and join them, they'd probably have to go back. So the slides are revealing and the photos are revealing about how they wanted to represent their lives, both to themselves and to the family back at home. When I, and the letters as well, when I asked Gwen in an interview in 2000, not, I wasn't thinking about the slides at the time, but I asked her, what did you not write home or talk about in your letters? And there were two things that instinctively came to mind, and she said straight out. And the first one, and she said, I couldn't tell my parents how sick I was on the whole of the voyage out. No sense in this. This is probably the only time that Gwen got up on the deck. She was appallingly ill on the voyage, the way out, and she didn't want her parents to know that. She also said, I couldn't tell my parents that we have had a corrugated iron roof on the house in Perth. Gwen and had grown up in the East End of London in pretty poor conditions. Dad had done quite well, and when she was a child, they'd moved to the new western, northwestern suburbs of outer London, where they had a semi-detached house with a tiled roof. To the East London sensibility that they'd grown up with, the corrugated, the tin roof was a sign of a slum. And so had she either written about or talked about the roof that they had in a typical Australian house as having a tin roof, it would have spelled out to the parents that things weren't going well, that they'd come, you know, they'd gone back to the slums, if you like. So nothing in the letters, but also in the photographs. I don't think I'm pushing it too far, but this is one of the first photos they sent of their first home in Victoria Park in the sort of inner suburbs of Perth. And this is Cliff with the iconic photo of the first new car standing outside the house. But the roof line of the house is carefully camouflaged. So this photograph, which was also sent home, there's nothing there to suggest that there's a tin roof. And it's not until 3 years later when they build their own first home, just around the corner, which is in this photo, the car again, the roof tiles are resplendently revealed in the photograph. So it's just a nice example of the sorts of things, ways in which people could and couldn't represent their life through photographs and through letters, and how in remembering, people can remember those silences as well as the presences in the narratives that they created at the time. That's quite a nice example. What I want to do is just give you two sort of probably more troubling and also more complex stories. And the first relates to Dorothy Wright, who's pictured here in this wonderful photo that Mike had bought a really fancy German camera duty-free on the ship on the way out to Australia. And this is one of the first photographs that he'd taken of Dorothy arriving in Sydney Harbour in 1959. Dorothy and Mike left from rural Surrey, where he had a job as an engineer, in 1959. She had a young son, and she discovered she was pregnant after they decided to come to Australia, but they decided to carry on. I can't help or can't resist in this context talking a little bit, just briefly, about the photo albums. Dorothy was a great letter writer. She sent weekly letters, particularly to her mother, but knew that they would be passed around the wider family. But Dorothy and Mike also sent every 6 months a photo album that they made. Mike was really skillful with his hands, and he handcrafted these albums. Dorothy was very artistic and creative, and she made the covers. And the covers usually had different types of iconic Australian imagery, like the yellow robin in this one, or Aboriginal motifs, like this one, which was done with what Dorothy describes as a Swiss stitch. They're just beautiful, beautiful objects. And the covers represent aspects of their life in Australia, particularly Australian wildlife, iconic imagery. And there's one which has a photograph of small children, which is one of the other main themes of the albums. I mean, she's probably going to donate the albums to an archive, but they'd make a wonderful museum exhibit about how these albums, which were not just about the photographs inside, but the very covers visually represented an aspect of their life in Australia. And I'll come back and talk about some of the photos that were in the albums that were sent. But I want to talk about Dorothy's first year and about her pregnancy and about the birth of Bridget and about how she felt in that first year. Dorothy's reassuring letters to her mother at the time, in almost the whole of this first year, convey the impression that she's busy but coping with being a mother in Australia, having a toddler and a new baby. Just occasionally, there's a glimpse of exhaustion and even misery that sneaks through within the letters. And I'll just go through some of these bits and pieces. The worst that she can write about her pregnancy is that she's uncomfortable and impatient. So this is the worst of it, really. Most of the letters are very positive about house buying and about discovering new places and so on. The worst that she can write about her pregnancy is that she's uncomfortable and impatient. On though 2 days before the birth, she writes, "Mike is beginning to feel the strain," so Mike, not Dorothy, "is beginning to feel the strain and says to me every morning rather pathetically, 'Have a baby today, Dossie.'" Dossie was the family nickname for her. A couple of months later, when Bridget's about 2 months old and Mike has just returned from a week working away up country, Dorothy admits to her mother in a letter, "I'm glad he's home, gets a bit boring on my own." And then she says that she feels fine but get tired at the end of the day, which isn't to be wondered at when I start at 6 a.m. and finish at 10:45 p.m. However, it won't last forever. 2 weeks later, writing on a miserable, dull, windy and cold day, this is Sydney, to the tune of Bridget exercising her lungs and Nicholas in his playpen beating hell out of one of my baking tins, she confides to her mother, "I always think that you will understand with two babies life is hectic and somewhat tiring." In August, she writes of another English mother with two small children that she's indeed feeling very lonely, and I can sympathise. We are only just coming out of the state ourselves. The careful language and the third person pronoun soften the impact of an omission which can only really be shared now once the worst is almost over. Then in November, Dorothy notes in passing in a letter to her mother that she was nearing screaming, or she had been nearing screaming point, and she and Mike agreed to use their £9 quarterly child allowance to pay for both children to stay with a childminder so that they could have their first weekend away together since arrival in Australia 11 months before. They go to a Peter Sellers movie, they have a picnic drive in the Blue Mountains, they have dinner with friends from Mike's work and look at the stars. And, she writes, "I had my first bathe in the Australian surf, most exhilarating and exciting." A fortnight later, in a letter to her sister Barbara, who often received letters that were more frank about domestic life than those to mother, but who'd heard nothing of her sister's difficulties about, any of her difficulties to this point, Dorothy now explained, "I feel as if I've just emerged from a rather bad dream. I look back over the last 7 months and feel with relief and some pride, well, alone I done it. Though not alone, Mike's been wonderful." So I guess what I'm suggesting is there are glimpses within the letters of what a difficult time Dorothy had in this first year. But it's really only afterwards, or only a little bit afterwards, that she can write in any depth at all about how difficult it had been, about screaming point. The photographs that she sent home also were pretty, didn't say a lot about the difficulties of that first year. There are lots of baby photos and toddler photos and outdoor photos and so on. You can just, and then there's this photo taken when Bridget was 13 weeks old. And I guess with photographs, she took the photographs of the baby to send home to show, as you do, new baby to grandmother. But if you look at Dorothy's posture and the look on her face, you can see that there's another story beneath the surface, but there's nothing, certainly not in the caption, there's nothing really to tell you about what was going on. 40 years later, when she wrote autobiographical account for our project, Dorothy was much more straightforward about what was going on. "Things were not right for me. I was still so lonely, especially as winter and short daylight hours drew on. I was homesick. I was overtired. Nights were disturbed by the children. Bridget cried a lot in the first 6 months, and I always went. Mike never heard. Did I suffer from culture shock? Always I had a terrible feeling in the pit of my stomach. I cried often, sometimes when I was on my own with the children, And I remember Nicholas at 2 years old trying so hard to comfort me. Perhaps all these things contributed, but it was not until years later, when Bridget was expecting her first baby and had all the latest books about pregnancy, etc., that I suspected the real cause, postnatal depression. I read to Mike the symptoms from her book and said, "Does that remind you of anyone?" Yes, he immediately knew that had been my problem, when such conditions were not spoken of, at least to me. But I battled on. And I guess it's a good example of where actually a language, a term, and a way of knowing her experience, a way of naming and articulating her experience and her depression becomes available so that she can tell that story. You know, partly it's the passage of time, partly she's not trying to reassure family back in England, partly she has new ways of articulating the story. Reading the letters of the time, both within the letters and between the lines, you get a sense that there are a whole range of factors that are impacting upon Dorothy's depression. Almost certainly some form of postnatal depression, physiological, hormonal, was there, and you know, it made sense for Dorothy 40 years on to explain it in those terms. But there were a whole range of factors, really obvious factors. You know, she was separated from extended family support networks. They moved to the sort of northwestern suburbs of Sydney where she had no friends for the first 3 or 4 months and almost no support networks at all. She had a difficult toddler and a young baby. That was really tough. Mike was away in the city working long hours and often interstate on engineering work. She had almost nothing of her own life. She'd had a very active volunteer and paid working life in England. Nothing of that to make positive sense. And at the time, she internalised her depression as her own inadequacy. And there's a very powerful, chilling letter that she writes in March 1961 to her mother, where she writes, talking about her toddler son, Nick, "I find him very difficult to entertain, especially in the mornings when I'm busy and I'm sure he's bored. So I thought school would be the answer. I'm not a good mother, not what Dr. Spock calls a slow mother, who leaves her chores to make sure Junior gets the right treatment. In fact, though I love my two children, I just loathe the continual hampered feeling. I'm afraid I'm apt to scream at him to get out and let me get on, which, as Mike points out, does neither of us any good. How does Barb, that's her sister, manage? I have a feeling she has a lot more patience than I." And I guess another factor was she had a really strong sense of what both a good mother but also a good housewife should be in terms of housework, and the tensions between different aspects of the expectation for a woman in 1960s Australia were very acute and were internalised by Dorothy as being not a good mother. And I guess in this writing and then in the interview, we've been able to tease out this much more complicated, nuanced, complex story and explanation of her experience as a young migrant mother in Australia. There's another photo which I want to show you, which is taken the following year, 1960. It's taken in 1961. It's one of the two photos that appear twice in the photo albums that she sent home. I don't know if she forgot that she'd already sent it. And this is one of those photos. It was very significant. Dorothy had grown up in wartime England when all the public swimming pools were closed. She'd never learned to swim. They started going to the beaches in Sydney. She was worried about the kids getting into trouble. So she took swimming lessons. She learnt to swim. She discovered that she loved swimming. She loved the sea. She was exhilarated by the surf and by the beach. And she argued that one of the things that brought her out of her depression was the physicality of the surf and the sea and swimming. There were other factors. She began to make friends. She developed networks of support. The kids were older. She got Nick into a nursery and so on. But the swimming was very important. It was very prevalent in the letters, in photographs, the sea. And this was about sort of a real significant change in her life. The other point I want to make is that it's a story that was significant at the time, but it's also a story that became more significant over time. She loved swimming. Eventually, Dorothy developed a career as a swimming instructor, both in Australia and then back in England. And so and she writes now, or in 2000, she has this lovely passage about learning to swim, the exhilaration of the surf, and she writes, "In the warmth I blossomed." And it's partly a blossoming, a coming out of depression, but it's also a blossoming of Dorothy herself and the development of independence, a new career, new opportunities. So the photograph that was important and sent in 1961 and sent twice achieves and assumes an even greater significance later in life, when the learning to swim becomes part of a bigger story of achievement and independence, of developing, I guess, a sense of herself as being more than just a good mother, but actually many other things beside. Now, I think I'm going to stop there. I do have a fourth example from Phyllis Cape, but I'd rather stop and talk to you and get questions and discussion. And I guess the point I've tried to make is that I'm very lucky with these four women to be able to look at different ways and different genre within which they've articulated their experience, letters, journals, photographs, written autobiographical accounts, and the interviews. So it's given me an opportunity to compare the different ways in which they articulate their experience in those different types of life stories, the sorts of forces and factors that encourage them to tell some stories and not others at different times, in different genre, for different reasons and so on. And I guess it's made me, as an oral historian, it's made me more humble about my interviews because the letters have all sorts of details that get lost to memory. But conversely, it's highlighted the fact that we can't simply say that the closer the source is to the moment, the more likely it is to be accurate and truthful, because we make new and sometimes better sense of our lives over time. And so I guess it's highlighted both the value of life story sources, but the fact that we do need to read them with a really careful and thoughtful alertness to the factors that shape the story that's told and that also conceals as much as it reveres. So I'll stop there, but I'd be really interested to hear what you make of these examples and sort of the thoughts that they evoke for you. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.